stand by. We're about to begin. Welcome to today's National Quality Forum conference call. Today's call is being recorded. Please go ahead.
Thanks, all, and welcome to the Cancer Endorsement Maintenance Breast Measures Work Group number 2. We're in phase 2 of the project. And quickly, I'd like to take a roll call of the steering committee members on the call. Steve Edge, David Pfister, Elaine Chotner,
here.
Karen Fields,
here.
Robert Miller,
here.
Elizabeth Hammond,
yes.
Okay.
Hi.
All right. So thanks for joining, and we also want to acknowledge that we have developers for each of the measures on call. We don't have our lead discussant for the first book. I'm sorry, for the first measure. And I'm sorry to prevail on you, Dr. Miller. I know that you're in a time crunch. Would you like to start our discussions with a discussion of measure number 387, oncology?
Yes, I can start with 387. I thought you were asking me to do 1857.
No. Okay. Sorry about that. No good deed
goes unpunished. I got it. Okay.
So you know the process for today is that we'll go through each criteria, looking at the measure, and you'll give us your impressions, and we'll open the measure for discussion for the full group after that.
Yes. Okay. So let me start with 387. Let me just pull it up since I had the other one open. Okay. So 387 is an AMA PCPI measure relating to the use of adjuvant hormonal therapy for women with early stage breast cancer. Specifically, the population is women age 18 or older with stage 1C through 3C. Disease that are either ER or PR positive, and the interest is what percentage were prescribed a standard adjuvant hormonal therapy, either tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitor, during the 12-month reporting period. The denominator is all women with a diagnosis. And in terms of the denominator exclusions, these seem fairly appropriate, i.e., disease being metastatic or patients having received a previous oophorectomy, patients who were past the date of diagnosis more than 5 years or were within a few months of the completion. Let's see, I guess that was diagnosis date within 3 months of the end of the 12-month reporting period. And in terms of the, let me just scroll here, in terms of the, starting with criterion one, the impact, I really didn't have any problem really with any of these, so I'll be very brief. This is a high-impact measure because of the prevalence of breast cancer and because this is a therapy that for which there's a very large database as to its effectiveness. In terms of a performance gap is not hugely robust, but the COPI project showed that the performance rate was 93.9%, and another study, a patterns of care study, was only 80%. So clearly there's some room for improvement there. So I had no concerns about importance to measure and report, both 1B, 1A and 1B. In terms of evidence, I think the evidence is robust, so we'll just leave it at that. And then let me just scroll down further here. Again, similarly, reliability, this measure as captured either electronically or in paper records should produce reliable results. And likewise, so I felt it met all the criteria for reliability. Likewise, under validity, scroll back up here. That this was the results were credible. In terms of usability, no real reservations there, since I felt that this was easily recognized by the stakeholders, both professional stakeholders and patient groups. and I felt it was highly feasible to do, since it's a metric that is captured in other ways. So bottom line, overall suitability, I did not have any reservations. I recommended my personal vote was for endorsement, and that's my report.
Thanks, Dr. Miller. Do we have comments from the larger work group?
Let me just interrupt really quickly. Operator, if you wouldn't mind opening up the lines for the AMA PCPI staff.
One moment.
Thank you.
And their lines are now open.
Okay, great. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead. Whoever was trying to speak before?
Comments from the larger work group?
I was wondering about it, whether or not it was needed to be, there needs overlap needs to be addressed with Measure 220.
We actually noticed that as well, and that'll be, once we have the full discussion at the in-person meeting, we'll be having a side-by-side comparison, assuming both measures meet the criteria for endorsement, where the steering committee can evaluate and see where there are opportunities for harmonization if necessary.
Good.
Does someone from PCPI want to weigh in on this before the in-person?
This is Pam Tierney with the AMA. I would just comment, I guess, the main difference I see between Measure 220 and our Measure 387 is that essentially I think they're conceptually the same, you know, measuring hormonal therapy and breast cancer patients, but I think that the Measure 220, or I know Measure 220, assesses performance at the facility level, and our measure is designed to assess performance at the physician level.
Thank you. Any other comments with regard to 387?
This is Steve Edge. Wouldn't it be better to measure the performance at the patient level? So in other words, we're concerned whether the patient gets it, not whether the facility is responsible or whether the doctor's responsible.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And the facility and the patient and the doctor really have shared responsibility.
So, Bam, do you want to speak to that? That they measure that they filled their prescription every month, or how would you measure that?
Well, actually, that's a very good way to do that. One can certainly do it with claims data very readily. If you have claims data, you can know where they fill it. It's a proxy for taking the medication. So I guess we need to reconcile the facility versus provider, but I would suggest that we err on the side of looking at the patient rather than, you know, trying to the attribution towards one or the other.
This is Lindsay. Just for the purposes of this work group call, as far as I'm discussing the measures, we're really not trying to do the head-to-head comparison of 220 and 387 just yet. As far as information for the measure developer, that's certainly useful, but we don't want to go too far into the comparison of the two.
Okay.
This is Karen Fields. I would think that both measures might be applicable. However, at the physician level, at least we're understanding if the provider's prescribing the medication appropriately. The healthcare disparities issue can be addressed about whether the patient had access or from a facility standpoint a little bit more. But I think it's hard to address the fact that the real problem is the failing of the system may be for the lower income or lower other minority economic or other or minority groups as far as accessing and getting appropriate medication.
All right. Other comments about this measure? So we'll get into a deeper discussion about the two measures as we get to the in-person meeting. Okay, moving back onto our usual schedule here, our stated schedule, we have measure number 1857, Trastuzumab.
I'm sorry, how do you pronounce that?
Perhaps Dr. Edge could pronounce it for us.
Trastuzumab.
Trastuzumab,
and we ask our patients to pronounce it or they don't get it, right?
Yes.
No, it's a good tongue twister, which is why everybody says Herceptin, but they really should be saying trastuzumab.
Gotcha, and I apologize for that.
That's okay.
Our measure developer for this measure is ASCO. We could open the lines for ASCO, and Dr. Stephen Edge is our lead discussant for this measure. And you can go ahead.
Great. Well, certainly trastuzumab is appropriate for a woman with HER2-positive breast cancer, as we'll discuss in a few minutes with another measure. And in general, its use for women with HER2-negative breast cancer is inappropriate, though one has to put an asterisk next to that, as the data from randomized trials suggests that, in fact, in the adjuvant setting, which is the setting suggested for this measure, that the odds ratio for disease-free recurrence is the same for women with HER2-negative as it is for HER2-positive cancers, as there was a subset of women on the original trials that were found on central review to be HER2-negative. And in fact, as I believe there's an ongoing national cooperative group clinical trial examining the role of trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting in women with HER2-negative breast cancer. So with that asterisk, it is generally not appropriate for women with HER2-negative cancer. The measure, therefore, measures a significant issue. The developer does not appear to have shown that there's a major issue with this question. On their own work with the Quality Oncology Practice Initiative, or COPI Initiative, the mean performance on this measure was 99%. There's no other data presented showing that there was further variation. There were the outlier practices where only eight, where the measure was at 80%, but there was no data provided on the number of cases, the median, the number of practices with outliers, or the estimated number of cases in the United States. There was no other data from payers or other sources provided to support that there's an issue in this. I was concerned in the definitions of the numerator and the denominator regarding this because the absence, the only way to really define this would be the absence of claims for trastuzumab, rather than relying on self-report of the physician. So in general, I found that, you know, certainly the level of evidence is high that you should not give this drug to women with HER2-negative cancer. Available data is that the concordance with this measure is already extremely high, which in many respects limits its value as a quality measure. Relying on self-reporting of the physicians in the COPI methodology with a random subset of physicians, so I don't think it would be adequate for the purposes of CMS reporting. And I'd like some more comments, I think, from the developer on some of those questions.
Do we have someone from ASCO on the line?
Their lines are open.
Hi, this is Kristen McNiff. If you hear me, I could begin to address some of...
Yes, we hear you.
Just to address the final concerns, I think, about the high concordance rate within COPI, the COPI participants are a self-selected group, so we do sometimes see a higher performance among the COPI participants, which are a group of practices, albeit a fairly large national group of practices, who have self-selected to participate in this quality improvement registry program. And thus, when we see a variation across the practices, then we think that there is room for improvement, regardless of whether there might be a high concordance overall. So we do position this as a measure that's important to assess more widely, as we do believe that there is a gap in performance. There have been some unpublished data from payers, but unfortunately they are not published, so we are not able to include them regarding the use of trastuzumab in patients for whom there has not been a claim submitted. And in terms of, we'll come to this later in the measure, but we do believe that HER2 testing should be documented by the medical oncologist, and that should be in the medical oncologist record. I agree that looking at claims is a way to find this information. However, ASCO has taken the position that if the oncologist does not have documentation that the patient is HER2 positive, then the treatment should not be given. So part of the definitional notes within our submission and within our measure is an absence of documentation counts as overuse of trastuzumab. So we do have the expectation that not only is there documentation that the test was administered, but there's documentation that of the HER2 status to support the use of trastuzumab. And I don't know if I believe Mike Hassett is on the call as well. He may have comments about some of the clinical questions that you raised, Steve.
Hi. Yes. Chris, this is Mike. I'm here. So I support all the stuff that you said. I think one of my concerns, acknowledging that the performance relative to the measure within the ASCO COPI program is relatively high, is kind of a valid concern, although, as Chris had alluded to, there are some non-published studies outside of that cohort that suggest some overuse for the drug. I think that there's at least some concern that as use of trastuzumab becomes more widespread, the tendency to overuse it may actually increase over time, and then therefore the tendency to see a declining performance relative to this measure is a potential in the future. I think that there's also a recognition and a desire to prioritize measures and to focus on aspects of care that not only address underuse of recommended therapies, but the potential overuse of non-recommended and potentially toxic therapies. With regard to the data in HER2-negative patients in trastuzumab, I think the best data that are out there are in patients with metastatic disease, which suggests no response rate to trastuzumab-based therapy. And
right.
There are a few subsets in the adjuvant trials of HER2-negative patients on central review, although a lot of those patients were HER2-positive on local review. And I think it's not clear about exactly how to interpret them. And I'd say the standard of care across the spectrum now is still against the use of trastuzumab for patients who have HER2-negative disease.
Honestly, in reading this measure, I was thinking that the measure might better be targeted at women with metastatic disease, because if I was asked where I thought we might see more overuse and people pressured to use this, it would be in the metastatic setting where treatment options may begin to be limited. So I was sort of wishing that you had written this measure for women with metastatic disease, but that's wishful thinking since you didn't do so.
And I think it's a good point in understanding where to take measures like this in the future and to expand them to, other populations. I think, at least my hope, speaking personally, is to start with an area where, to start at one point and then continue to raise the bar. And I think focusing on patients with metastatic disease may be an interesting direction to continue to grow with this type of measure. I think also this question may become a little bit more complicated in breast cancer therapy as the role of HER2-targeted therapy, the use of HER2-targeted therapy becomes more complicated. There are some studies now in patients with metastatic disease who have ER-positive HER2-negative disease and have progressed on hormonal therapy where investigators are exploring the use of HER2-targeted therapies. Mm-hmm. As a treatment, because of this theory that secondarily they develop overactivation of the HER2 pathway. For that reason, And because there's a little more flux in the metastatic cohort, and to some extent the consequences of being wrong are perhaps a little bit less right now, and the population's smaller, this seemed like a good place to start as we sort out some of the questions with metastatic disease.
Is there an exception in here for the numerator for women who are on a clinical trial? I didn't see it, but... I believe this is there's an NSABP trial for women with HER2 negative cancer to receive trastuzumab.
I don't remember off the top of my head. My feeling would be that, you know, if you're getting trastuzumab as part of a clinical trial, that shouldn't be
right.
counted against you, and that's
right. I think you might want to examine all of your measures and make sure there is such a clinical trial exception in the numerator.
So there is, Steve. If you look at top of page
okay.
7.
I'm sorry if I missed it.
Okay. Yeah, so we do, if the trastuzumab was administered according to a clinical trial protocol,
Perfect.
Then that actually counts as being concordant with the measure.
Perfect. Oh, yes, I see it there. I'm sorry.
So this is Bob Miller.
What do other members of the committee feel about this issue of the very high level of reported concordance and the absence of other data showing that there is a practice gap here?
So, Steve, this is Bob Miller, and I do have trouble with this one because it just doesn't ring true to me as a breast oncologist that I really wish we would feel a lot better about putting this measure forth if we could demonstrate a performance gap in another data set. You know, I remember in my previous location a local payer alleging that oncologists were routinely using Herceptin for HER2 negative patients, but when we tried to analyze those data, it really came back to the testing issue and the documentation issue. And certainly, I mean, I agree with what I think was Mike Hassett just said about, if, or maybe it was Kristen said about, it needs to be documented. But I just don't see this as one of the big problems of our time, and I just have trouble with the premise of this measure. I mean, the evidence that you shouldn't do it is very strong, but I just feel like it fails on the performance gap about showing me that this is really a problem that needs to be corrected in this fashion.
This is Liz Hammond. I totally agree with that suggestion. I don't think there is a performance gap. The data is strong, but I'm not supportive of this measure because I don't think it's an area, a place where we have a problem.
This is Karen Fields. I guess I'm the one that wrote wide performance gap because if there's 20% of the patients in some practices getting Herceptin inappropriately, I thought that was significant. So can the developer tell us a little bit more about, I understand 99% mean, but if there's practices giving a costly toxic drug inappropriately, I thought that was a significant issue.
This is Kristen. So I would have to pull additional numbers. We don't go back to the practices with the poor performance and, do any additional data collection from them. So the data that they report are really the data that we have. That said, if, you know, we can certainly...
Well, I mean, Steve's point was it a practice of three patients and... or something like that, but I'm sorry, just 20% of the people getting a drug that costs $100,000 a year is appropriate. So I think it's a performance gap, and I would think it was a reasonable measure to evaluate. I defer to other people's thoughts on that, but I understand that we're very compulsive at academic centers documenting HER2 status, making sure that we're measuring HER2 correctly, and making sure that we're not giving a drug when it's not indicated. But clearly there was a performance gap on a group of providers that voluntarily submitted their data to this to COPI, and it just was striking to me.
So what I'm going to suggest at the before the in-person meeting that ASCO provide us the exact question that was asked and the exact data elements that were provided from the medical oncologist's office, and B, provide us a statistical analysis of this rather than just the mean in the range. I suspect this was very, very few patients, probably one or two practices, a very outlier practice rather than affecting a lot of patients. But I think we could see a more definitive statistical analysis of this practice pattern.
Coming in and looking at the dots.
Pardon me?
We're going to have the exact same discussion when we get to the HER2 testing, where there was a 98% concordance, but the performance gap was 75% to 100% in the practices surveyed. So this is a broader issue.
Kristen, with the statistical analysis that they're asking for, is that something that we could feasibly have by the in-person meeting?
Yes.
All right, great. Thank you.
And if I'm allowed to, I could even talk with Kristen offline about how we might structure that, but only if I'm allowed to by NQF.
Yeah, you're allowed to. If you wouldn't mind just looping one of us in on that conversation, that would be great.
Okay. Kristen, we can try to do it if it helps for me to be involved.
Okay. Any other comments about 1857? So we'll go to the next measure, which is 1858, and it's trastuzumab administered to patients. It actually is. With early stage cancer. And we did have Dr. Pfister to as lead discussant for this, but he's not able to join the call. Is there someone from the steering committee willing to lead discussion of this one?
Well, I'm happy to generally review it. Certainly, the practice guidelines call for the use of trastuzumab to be administered with chemotherapy to women with T1C stage 1 cancers or stage 2 and 3 breast cancers that overexpress or have amplified HER2. Sidebar is that we might recommend that the ASCO consider changing the title to trastuzumab is administered with chemotherapy to patients with blah, blah, blah. But that's a sidebar. The measure is applied to women women 18 years of age and older who have HER2-positive cancers administered within 4 months of a diagnosis. And as I recall reading this, it's for 1 year of treatment as stipulated by the randomized clinical trials. There's very high-level evidence. This is one of the most dramatic effects we've seen. Certainly, this is a treatment which has saved, which is going to be saving many, many, many lives over the time. I wasn't prepared to give this discussion. I don't remember the evidence. Kristen, is ASCO on the line right now?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Yeah, Kristen. What page is the data on which it was the data supporting this? I'm sorry, because I wasn't prepared to do this.
The data supporting the use of trastuzumab.
Showing the practice. No, the data showing the practice variation.
Oh, let me scroll to that.
I'm terribly sorry that I'm not prepared to do this.
Okay, if you look, I think it's in two places. On the bottom of 13. So it's another with a high mean concordance and range across the practice, 97% of a mean, and a min 60, 100 max.
Yeah. Again, you might consider doing the same kind of analysis for us for this, given that finding. Of course, this might be more complicated, and Dr. Hassett might want to comment. This might be more complicated because there may be other factors, particularly that impact on this question, and that's one of the issues that I had reviewing the measure, is that there is no upper age limit cutoff. There's only the consideration that the physician documented that they weren't going to give the treatment because of comorbidities, or I don't remember the exact wording. But your statistical analysis might have to include a multivariable analysis, which might be more difficult to do in the next 2 weeks, factors associated with omission of trastuzumab in this setting. Dr. Hassett, do you have any thoughts on that question?
So I would say that very likely age is going to be associated with the absence of trastuzumab therapy for HER2-positive breast cancer, as is a comorbid disease. Although, at least in the studies, age wasn't associated with a decrement in benefit from trastuzumab therapy, which is in contradistinction to the story with adjuvant systemic chemotherapy in general. I think for healthy people who are generally healthy, regardless of age, there's actually been a push to use trastuzumab in these folks. And part of that is, I think, because of the concern that the risk of relapse is relatively early. So, you know, even in a, you know, an 82-year-old, if that 82-year-old has a HER2-positive breast cancer, that breast cancer could recur in the next 1 to 3 years. And it's not the, it's to some extent the risk of recurrence and its distribution over time isn't the same as what one would expect for an ER-positive cancer.
Right. I had this very discussion with a 79-year-old woman with a 8-millimeter HER2-positive cancer earlier this week. So you can see we're going to have an interesting time as we get her, all her pathologic data coming forth. I think the committee is going to have to decide, does the exclusion of the doctor saying it's not appropriate to give this treatment, is that sufficient for excluding somebody from the numerator or including somebody in the numerator as being concordant? I think that's something that our committee needs to discuss.
This is Karen Fields. I was the one that put the other exclusion was the cardiac exclusion. That should be lifted as an exclusion. One of the other questions I asked, one of my other comments was, it's not always easy to get that 4-month window, and so maybe the variation in the performance gap was that there was delays in surgical treatments in the first place or other delays, so perhaps the variability was due to measuring for 4 months, for receiving Herceptin within 4 months, or trastuzumab within 4 months?
We have the same issue when we're measuring chemotherapy administration along the measure that's being applied through the Commission on Cancer. I don't remember the number for the NQF. I believe Andrew Stewart is on the phone, though he's probably muted at the time. And if he can be unmuted, I was going to ask him if he could, off the top of his head, give us an estimate of the number of patients who with ER-negative breast cancer whose therapy begins after 4 months. Karen, I think that's a really important point.
His line is now open.
Sorry to put you on the spot, Mr. Stewart, but...
Thanks, Steve. The number, proportionally, it's less than 5%.
Really? Okay.
I remember doing the sensitivity analyses on that measure a number of years ago, looking at a portion of women in the measure-appropriate denominator who initiated the adjuvant therapy outside the timeline that we were considering, which ended up being 120 days or 4 months. And it was one of the reasons for selecting that time frame limit was to make sure that we were giving all institutions that we work with equitable or even opportunity to demonstrate patient concordance with the measures. And I think in the end it was less than 5%, but I can double check and bring that information.
Okay.
But I have actually raised a slightly different issue, because you're just talking about beginning adjuvant therapy. And Herceptin has to follow on the heels of anthracycline-based therapies.
Oh,
so
Herceptin might good not point.
Right, I was going to say the same thing.
Good point.
This is Bob Miller, and I actually would be very surprised that it's that low in an unselected population, that it's only 5% don't make the four-month cutoff, because the way the numerator reads, administer within 4 months of diagnosis. So, the first diagnosis made on a core needle biopsy, in our institution, it could be longer than it should be, but by the time they've had their definitive surgical procedure, they have their tissue expanders in, then they get 2 months of AC before they start their taxane and Herceptin. I think there's a lot of that going on.
I don't think it's inappropriate either, because they'll have started systemic therapy, which was what you were quoting the data on. It's
exactly.
Right. I'm actually looking at an unpublished study we have from the NCCN that we're working on right now. I have it open on my computer, looking at time to start chemotherapy from date of diagnosis at NCCN centers. And about 85 to 90% of women start chemotherapy by 16 to 17 weeks, or about 4 months. So I think ASCO should take a real look at this measure to say when the trastuzumab should actually start, or revise the measure to say something on the, and this is just a suggestion, say something on the order of begin systemic therapy that includes trastuzumab by 4 months or whatever time is selected, because the chemotherapy, is, as Karen said, will start, and the trastuzumab actually may well not start for another 2 or 3 months.
Yeah.
Does ASCO want to make any comments on Karen, Kristen, or Mike? Do you want to make a comment on that?
Well, we certainly will take that into advisement that this is a useful discussion. The thing I will say is that ongoing receipt of AC is a denominator exclusion.
But that means everybody's going to fail. All the centers are going to fail, mm-hmm. because in the best case scenario, if we heard 85% of the NCCN centers get it started within 4 months, and they're starting the anthracyclines, that's a 2 to 3 month delay before you start the Herceptin.
Right.
That means 85% of centers are going to fail.
So, Kristen, you just said that ongoing AC is a denominator exclusion, and if you exclude women who get AC, you're excluding the majority of the women who will go on to get trastuzumab.
People who are still receiving their AC.
Right,
but then how does the timeline work for this measure?
Because you capture people in our sample who had completed their AC.
But then they have started trastuzumab more than 4 months after diagnosis.
Yeah.
I think what you're hearing is the timeline probably needs to be worked, and I think you and Mike and others probably might want to rethink it. And again, if you want Karen or me or someone to help you think it through, that could be done.
This is Liz Hammond. I also have a concern about not a concern about the timeline, but I have a concern about whether or not we're really adequately measuring the right thing here. I mean, the Herceptin, there are positive incentives for people to give Herceptin to patients, but they might be giving it to patients, as we've discussed, too late, but more likely they're giving it to people who shouldn't be getting it because they have cardiac problems, or they should be evaluating them for cardiac problems. I mean, I think there should be something in this measure that helps us know that the patients are being carefully evaluated, especially those that have been on AC, for cardiac problems or risk factors that would make it likely for them to have a problem with Herceptin. Because if you're looking to make a measure that's going to have importance, that would be the way to do it.
Yep, so I think that's a very useful feedback. We do have a specific clinical inclusion the details of which are not provided, and we could certainly add them, that cardiac toxic or cardiac disease is one of the specific issues noted. And I agree that's a very important measure. I think it's a little bit of a different measure, and what I hear from you is maybe that, you know, your feeling is that is the more important quality issue. But this is all helpful feedback. I don't know, Mike, if you have any comments. We can definitely, you know, think about this more after the call.
Yeah, I would agree that these comments have been excellent with regard to the cardiac issue. The incidence of people who start AC, the incidence of cardiac toxicity between the initiation of AC and the initiation of trastuzumab is relatively low. There aren't a lot of population-based analyses of adequacy of cardiac function testing during that period of time, although I am part of a group that's trying to drill down on that question actually presently, and we're trying to put some data together around that particular issue, and just anecdotally have not seen a lot of risky behavior with trastuzumab therapy in patients who have cardiac toxicity that develops after the initiation of AC. But but it sounds like kind of drilling down a bit more on some of the denominator exclusions in the timeline. We can talk about those.
Yeah, patients who have been on AC ought to be reevaluated for their cardiac status. Because, and that's the point, is that if you're trying to think about measures that are going to actually help patients, then the best measure would be for any doctor who's thinking of using trastuzumab to make sure that the patient doesn't have any cardiac toxicity prior to the initiation of that drug, and especially patients who have been on AC. Not before they got the AC, but after.
Is that true in terms of standard practice for giving standard ACT trastuzumab, that reevaluation for cardiac status is done after completion of AC? We have a number of medical oncologists on the phone.
I personally would say that's not standard practice. That was how the first clinical trials were done. But if you're giving AC in the standard doses, you're getting below, and you did a baseline cardiac function, and you gave less than 300, you gave 300 milligrams per meter squared or less as the usual adjuvant regimen. People don't always get that second MUGA to decide about giving Herceptin, because you stayed within safe limits in a healthy person, and we showed that we didn't, like, less than, 4 to 10% of the patients get cardiac toxicity. But a history of cardiac toxicity or decreased ejection fraction should be an exclusion criteria. And then some practices may do MUGAs, but I don't know that every practice does a MUGA prior to Herceptin.
But if you think about this from the patient's perspective, even 4 to 10% of cardiac toxicity is a pretty bad outcome.
And it was always pretty much reversible with discontinuation of the drug. I understand. It's just that's a separate practice question. That's a little. I think it's an very important issue, which is we understand that the appropriate patients are getting the drug appropriately and they're being monitored adequately for toxicities. It's just taking an ejection fraction right after anthracyclines may not, if in a patient that had a previously normal MUGA, may not answer that question.
It would at least be worthwhile to do some general questions of the patient to find out, and physical examination to find out whether or not there are any signs of cardiac toxicity, because I'm well aware. I'm a heart transplant pathologist in addition to being a cancer pathologist, and I see patients who have had very poor outcomes, in fact required transplantation from adriamycin, some of whom have been on low doses. So I have a healthy disrespect for adriamycin in terms of its cardiac toxicity. It's not a benign drug. And I think it would be smart, it seems like having a measure just to make sure that everybody who's got a positive HER2 test gets Herceptin is something that is already something every medical oncologist would want to do. There are already incentives to do it. What we want to do is incentivize doctors to do things that they might not do that are important for patients.
And I don't disagree that adriamycin is not a benign drug. Okay. So hearing the comments on this measure, Kristen, it sounds like there's this measure and then a measure that the committee would like to see. We might have to get with you offline to see what, if anything, can be done with this measure to make sure that, to see if there's any changes that we can make based on the suggestions received today.
Great, we will do that.
Still make the measure, because, the only concern is how the measure was tested and whether it would still hold up if certain things were added or modified in certain ways.
Okay, we'd be happy to have that conversation with you.
Thanks. Are there any other comments about 1858? Okay. All right, moving on. Our next measure is 1878, HER2 testing in breast cancer. ASCO is also the measure developer for this measure, and Dr. Karen Fields is our lead discussant. Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Elaine Chatner is our lead discussant for this measure.
This measure, I think, is very straightforward. There's a large body of evidence supporting doing HER2 testing. It's high impact in the number of patients that are involved. It's feasible, the data are reliable and valid. The same issue comes up, though, again, which is with the concordance. And this, again, is based on COPI data. And I've lost the section, but it was about 7,000 patients and 200 and some practices with 98% concordance and 75 to 100% in practices. So I think that it's easy to endorse it, except for the question about whether there really is a gap in care.
Thank you. Are there any other comments about the measure from the larger work group?
This is Bob Miller. Just wondering people's thoughts about whether there should be a denominator exclusion based on size. We routinely check HER2 for any invasive cancer, but I think that most clinicians are unlikely to prescribe trastuzumab as a therapy for HER2-positive cancers that are T1A, so 5 millimeters or smaller, although I know there's some people that do that. But there might be a small subset of patients that have very tiny invasive tumors where HER2 testing is not possible. I'm not sure I think that lets them off the hook for getting it tested, but I just, you know, trying to look at all sides on this and make sure that we're not penalizing some small percentage of situations where the results of the test may have no clinical implications.
This is Elaine. I concur that we did not usually test tumors less than 5 millimeters.
I just was going through the protocol, and it does quote the NCCN guideline that says 0.6 to 1 centimeters in node negative patients should be the only group considered for trastuzumab. So that would suggest that most people aren't looking at it below at 0.5 or less.
I mean, I'm playing devil's advocate because at my institution, and I'm sure many, you know, we still have the discussion with patients when we know it's HER2 positive and it's a 4 millimeter tumor, because there might be we don't have data. You know, I think that's pretty clear. But in the absence of data, practice patterns are such that it's not at all unheard of that trastuzumab is used in the adjuvant setting. So. But I'm just trying to think this through about whether size should enter into this at all or not.
In smaller tumors that were high grade or estrogen receptor negative. So I think that you would like to leave that flexibility and not ding people for not checking it in small low grade tumors.
Perhaps Dr. Hammond has a comment here, but I think in general most people generally do these biomarker tests on an invasive cancer, with the exception of when there is too little tumor on which to perform the test.
That's correct. That's absolutely correct, Steve. We always do it. We do it routinely on anything that's invasive cancer. So the test is done. Whether or not the patient receives the treatment is not, you know,
right.
is different.
But the place you will find, if you review the PATH report, where there is no report of a HER2 test, is where there was only 2 millimeters of cancer, and when you cut the block again to make another slide to do the HER2 test,
yeah,
there isn't any tumor. there just isn't any tumor. So so that's why you might have a size cutoff. The problem is if you put a size cutoff into the measure, you may be giving the subtle message that you don't need to do this, and then you'll find the practice changing because of the measure, which would be unfortunate.
Right. I think that, you know, we are just in the process of revising the HER2 guideline again, actually, this year, and there's strong sentiment on the part of the medical oncologists that are on that team to, you know, give patients what they call the benefit of the doubt, since Herceptin is a very, very effective drug. They are pushing on us to make sure that the guideline doesn't ever allow patients who don't have HER2 by some means or another from keeping them from getting trastuzumab. So I support the idea of removing the size inclusion just because of all the things that have been said. I think the guideline, it actually conflicts with the guideline as it currently exists and will in the future, and that is saying that we advocate that in the guideline that every patient who has any invasive cancer gets the test performed.
Yeah. Ultimately, this is Bob again. I'm fine with that. I just want to raise the point. I want to make sure we weren't making this too narrowly defined, but I'm clinically, I kind of agree with you.
And I would just like to point, this is Kristen, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
I'd like to point out that insufficient sample for results is included as a data element within the numerator.
Good.
Other comments about this measure? Okay. All right, hearing none, we'll move on to 1855, quantitative HER2 evaluation by IHC uses the system recommended by the ASCO CAP guidelines. And this is a measure jointly developed by ASCO and the College of American Pathologists. Our lead discussant for this measure is Karen Fields, and if you would like to tee up the measure for us, Dr. Fields.
Sure. This measure proposes that we understand the percentage of patients that get quantitative breast HER2-new immunohistochemistry evaluation using the existing ASCO CAP guidelines. Either manually or with a computer-based assist program using the optimized algorithm for testing. The numerator is all patients receiving quantitative breast HER2 immunohistochemistry, and the denominator is all patients that are HER2 positive, and there were no exclusions. Breast cancer is high impact, and we've already discussed that it's a useful and an important piece of information when making therapeutic decisions about patients with breast cancer because of whether or not we should give trastuzumab, and I won't reissue any of those things. The guidelines were developed several years ago, and basically explaining when we should use FISH assays to further quantify the immunohistochemistry staining. And the reason that the developers, and I'd love to hear a little bit more from the developers, and I love the fact that I had a colleague that was a pathologist helping me do this assay, but initially anything greater than 10% staining was called positive. Now we have ranges of positive, which is greater than 30% of the invasive tumors intensely pick up the stain around the entire membrane versus equivocal, which is 30% versus negative, which is less than that. So, and then it then if we're equivocal, we think about utilizing FISH testing to further quantitate the positivity or of the HER2 test. what I didn't understand about this guideline is, or what I understood, and I hope I'm explaining it correctly, is that it's a measure that's based on clinical guidelines, but there's not a lot, there's a presumption that because the manufacturing guidelines are different than the clinical guidelines, that there's a performance gap. But there was no data presented that there was a performance gap, rather than the suggestion that there's probably a performance gap because of the difference between the guidelines and the manufacturer's suggestions for using the guidelines. And so their validity testing and reliability testing was to be determined as part of the development of this measure. I thought that all the data is indirect data. Although there was a suggestion in the data initially that when CAP did a survey of 757 labs, only 84% of the labs surveyed used the scoring criteria correctly. So that was the evidence to support the use of this. There's no randomized trials or anything to look at this particular aspect. All the randomized trials are related to why we want to use the data once we have it, rather than how we're developing the data. So I think it's a valid measure if we think that there's a disparity that's as high as 84%. And that gets back to some of the comments earlier about when we did central reviews, we changed the patients from positive to negative, from negative to positive. So I thought that it was a valuable measure, and I recommended it for consideration.
Right. This is. Can I make a comment at this point? This is Liz Hammond. There is a kind of a difficult circumstance that's arising now. As I mentioned just a minute ago, the guideline is under review it's being reassessed, and we hope get published with revisions as an update to the. So the previous guideline was published in 2007. We're planning to publish this update of it in 2012. We hope we'll make it by the end of 2012. But one of the issues that has come up is using this difference in the interpretation criteria for immunohistochemistry. That criterion was put in at the time, and there have been two published papers that have documented that it is valid to do that because virtually all well-handled specimens will fall above the 30% cutoff. But there is a little bit of data that wasn't provided in this guideline, but it does exist. But there are complaints about using that difference to 30% that may cause a complete revision of the way in which we define the interpretation guidelines in the new guideline. It would be a shame to put out a measure with all the work that's required for validity testing and so on if the guideline is going to be revised. So maybe one of the ways to deal with that would be instead of making the measure specific to this particular aspect of the guideline, it would be useful to try to develop a measure that asks the question of how many laboratories are compliant with the guideline. Because we believe that the guidelines on this subject are helping laboratories do a better job of testing and getting rid of the variation and the errors. But we don't know that for sure, and a measure that required evaluation of whether laboratories were following it would be a useful way to do it. Otherwise, I think there may be some issues with putting this measure forward now. Although I totally support it as well, if it stands. But if it doesn't stand, then we will be creating a measure that where the guideline has changed, and I can't tell you what's going to happen until after the deliberations are over.
And sorry, just to interrupt for a second. If we could get Faye Schmansky's line open, please.
Hello, this is Faye. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, one of the things I was thinking, because this guideline is just making sure that you're using the ASCO CAP scoring system, if the scoring system changes, we can change the footnote, but the measure is still accurate, right? I mean, the measure would still stand if you just
Absolutely. Use the system. Yeah. Yeah, that would be a good way to do it. That would be a good way to do it, just so the major developers understand that there is a strong chance that something will change.
And Dr. Hammond, this is Angela. This would change would be reflected, the change in the underlying guideline would be reflected at the annual update that the developers would provide. That would be addressed.
Also, because this measure is presented for time limited endorsement, it will undergo another review in 12 months when the testing is provided.
Okay, that sounds great. So then my comments were related to my lack of understanding about how this process really works, but I guess I'll get...
Apologies, we didn't introduce it properly, sorry.
Yes, and this is all good information to know as part of the process. So we'll be looking for that update when it comes out. Other comments from the developer or the steering committee about this measure?
No, I defer completely to the group's opinion on that one. It's Karen Fields.
Okay, nothing else from me.
Okay. So as Lindsay said, this measure would be evaluated as suitable for time-limited endorsement. So we'll carry that forward to the in-person. Our next measure on the list is measure number, we skipped, for those of you who weren't maybe earlier on the call, went early with 0387, and our last measure on the docket is 0391, breast cancer resection pathology reporting, PT category, primary tumor category, and PN category, regional lymph nodes with histologic grade. And this is an AMA PCPI measure. And our lead discussant is Dr. Elizabeth Hammond.
All right. So which one, I'm confused, which one is it we're doing first?
391.
391. Okay, great.
We already had a discussion of 387.
All right, that's right. I was on the call when that happened. I was just confused. Okay, so this measure is a measure that seeks to evaluate how likely it is that pathology reports contain the requisite information that is critical for patient care, including the stage, the extent of disease, the PT category, the nodal status, and the histologic grade, all elements that have been found repeatedly to relate to the outcome of patients, the prognosis, and are also all important in the way in which the patient is treated. The disease definitely has high impact, and this has been cited. There is a nice discussion about the value of this kind of measure. Data related to the performance gap shows that there is a gap of 35.87% of patients who have not had the appropriate information provided, if I'm reading that correctly. So it appears that there is a significant performance gap the quality of the data here is data that's been cited numerous times. There's information on the cancer protocol of the College of American Pathologists is one of the cited things, as well as the NCCN breast cancer guidelines, all of which cite specific information. There were no specific studies dealing with consistency of information, but the there's an implicit idea that this that these things are important not only in breast cancer, but consistency is across all cancers have been shown that there is marked value for reporting the stage of disease as well as the grade of the cancer in various types of cancers across the body. So consistency information is also very good. The way in which the quality of the data is all from these guidelines, as we have found in dealing with other performance measures where we were looking at pathology reporting, it's basically similar to the other ones in terms of the quality and consistency of the data, so it would be determined to be moderate. The reliability of the data should be excellent because the information is required to be reported in many institutions or all institutions, and final path reports usually have to have this information. Information that should be easily obtainable and reliably obtainable from electronic medical records. All breast cancer resection reports would be included. They are excluding biopsies, and biopsies are sometimes considered excision specimens. So I think part of the problem might be the way in which the biopsies are evaluated. The measure developer might describe for us whether or not how they're going to be able to tell an excisional biopsy from an incisional biopsy, because excisional biopsies can in fact be breast resection specimens. So the data is reliable, it's valid. The way in which it's being obtained and the codes that are put there should be excellent. There should be there have been studies of the reliability, and those reliability estimates were excellent. They were 100%, so that would seem to be not any kind of an issue. The utility of the measure is good because the data is available in an electronic means. In summary, I believe that this is a very important measure and should be approved and carry forward.
Thank you, Dr. Hammond.
Can I ask a question maybe of the developers or maybe of Dr.
Yes.
Hammond? I'm assuming that when they're talking about this, they're talking about that it's in the final report, which might include multiple biopsies or multiple resection reports, rather than because patients get returned to surgery for margins, and so sometimes there'll be these summary reports. But it wasn't as clear to me in the measure, because the numerator statement says reports that include T category, N category, and histologic grade, and then the numerator is each final report, but I don't know if it's that final summary, final diagnosis report, and I want
right.
to know. Okay.
That's an excellent question, and it causes dramatic problems for patients and physicians as well as pathologists, because there are usually multiple reports that have this information, and how does anyone know which one is the most important report? So I think this is a serious issue. Some information about it should be addressed by the measure developer, and also by the way in which we're handling breast cancer reports. The College of American Pathologists currently has a reporting cancer reporting initiative going on to try to address the problem and create what's called a summary or an integrated report. and but probably it should have a separate code so that it could be specifically targeted, and that doesn't exist at this point in time. So it's not a problem of the major developer, it's a problem of the way in which we're reporting these malignancies.
Did anyone from the developer side want to chime in on that one? Do we have the lines open for AMA, PCPI, and
CAP?
CAP?
One moment. I do have AMA, PCPI open. I will open CAP for you.
Thank you.
Their lines are now open.
This is Molly Siegel from the AMA PCPI. I think that's a great question. As was stated, it wasn't the issue of the measure developers, but what is available to pathologists currently. And I think that if that were to change, that's something that we could then revise the measure to accordingly, which is something that we do. Time. So I just wanted to add that. I'm not sure if somebody from CAP would like to also comment.
This is Faye. Is David Witte's line open as well?
I'm here.
Okay. I think the way the denominator is specified, it would be any report that the pathologist signs off on, and I just wanted to ask Dr. Woody if he agrees with that.
Well, it would strike me that that would be true, Faye. I remember we had many discussions about specimens other than the first removal of breast cancer, but I don't remember us discussing whether the multiple reports would all have that information. And I think it's an excellent question, but I think the way the denominator is chosen, as you point out, it would affect every report, would it not?
I believe.
Yeah, it would. Well, and you know, this is Liz Hammond again. There have been reviews. I've done reviews in Intermountain Healthcare, for example. There commonly maybe at least two reports which have data like this. All the reports may provide a grade designation. Many of them may provide a PT designation, especially if they're resection specimens of some kind. So it is a confounding factor, and I think the fact that the College of American Pathologists is planning to try to address this through its it has an informatics committee called the DIHIT committee, which has actually taken this on as a major initiative. So I think as it goes through yearly updates, there will be a time where the confounding of this particular issue will be addressed.
I think that's the right approach.
Yeah. This is V.O. Spates also with the College of American Pathologists. I mean, I think what we're talking about here is a very good measure with really an inescapable
right
question, because the fact is that all we can do is report on what we have. It's certainly possible that we may have a specimen, a breast, or other things, which has a T category and an N category, and then there's a scan that shows a metastasis somewhere else, or possibly even a different procedure, a fine needle aspiration, maybe done somewhere else that we don't have immediate access to. So the best we can do is give the T and the N according to what we have at the time, with the idea that there can always be more information, more specimens that come up either through our laboratory or even someone else's that shows something more advanced.
I guess my point of bringing this up was, since breast cancer sometimes gets done in stages, like there's the excisional biopsy sometimes, or the margins are positive, and then there may be the lymph node, there may be the sentinel node biopsy, and then later an axillary node biopsy. What tends to happen at our institution is there's a series of
pathology reports that are combined, but at the end, the pathologist does the TNM and all the other prognostic indicators and summarizes all of those things. And I think that's really the goal of reporting, is that somebody puts all that together, and I'm not necessarily talking about, and later they did the liver biopsy. I don't think that would be the pathologist's responsibility to do that. But the summary path of the primary therapy for the breast cancer comes out sometimes in dribs and drabs. And not all centers, I don't think, put them together in one way. And that's, but the goal would be to get to hold people accountable for that final path for that primary therapy.
Right. That is what we need, and the college is working on that through an initiative of its of one of its committees, and the head of that initiative is a Dr. George Birdsong, who I think is at Emory, and that is it's a breast cancer was one of the major things that they addressed that was a problem here. So I think that that will be, that this will get handled. But in the meantime, we have to use the measure. It is a valid measure and it is a good measure. We have to go forward the way it is. But I think it will spur the college on if we make the comment that it is good for us to head towards summary reports.
Because what happens is, unfortunately, the treating clinician is the one that has to try to piece it together. So we're adding up tumor sizes and trying to add up lymph nodes, and we're not always very accurate at that.
And VO Spates, again, one of the problems you have when you have, say, an initial biopsy that has some but not all of the tumor, and then you have a further resection that has more tumor, then it's sometimes hard to put the jigsaw pieces together and know what the actual tumor was. But, that, again, that's a really an inescapable problem.
No one is better qualified than the pathologist to help us figure that out, to summarize that data.
Right, and it behooves us to have access to all the appropriate reports so that we can put that data together.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Any other comments on 387?
391.
Sorry, 391. Not a good day.
I want to make it clear, I did think it was an important thing to endorse. I just wanted to make sure I understood what the measure was.
So will there be some feedback formally from NQF regarding this development of a summary report, and that would be something that a revised measure would include? Is that kind of where we end up with this?
Well, we haven't talked about the measure. We would discuss this measure more at the in-person meeting and formalize those comments about the measure at that time.
We have to look at
the measure as it is before us.
Not disagreeing with anything that's been said, but as Dr. Hammond had earlier said, at the moment there isn't any way to code that.
No, there isn't. We have to wait. We can make the comment. I don't think we could approve the measure as it is and with the comment and strong recommendation that we go forward developing a summary report on breast cancer patients. Actually, it should happen on all cancer patients, not just breast cancer patients, because it puts the clinician who's treating the patient in a difficult situation trying to assess which of these pieces of paper is the one that they should pay attention to. So I think all we can do at this point, Faye is right, we don't have a code for that, we don't have a way to collect the data yet, but that's what the college is working on, and if we say that that's strongly endorsed, that they continue to work on that, I think they'll push it forward faster, and that will help us all.
And certainly in the report for this project, we can note that that is a gap area for future measure development in addition to the recommendation you've just provided.
Great.
Okay. So additional comments about this one? All right.
If we we could get all lines open at this point to see if there's any member or public comment.
All lines are now open.
Any member or public comment? Okay, hearing none, as far as next steps for the steering committee members, the in-person meeting is 2 weeks away, May 23rd and 24th in D.C. If you haven't booked travel or RSVP'd, please do so. Our meetings department has sent you an email. We will be providing a compilation of the summaries of the work group calls, and we'll be sending them out to you midweek next week for your review prior to the in-person meeting. Other than that, thank you so much for your time, both steering committee members and developers, and please feel free to contact us with any questions in the interim. You are free to go. 3 minutes early.
Thank you very much.
Thank you all for joining.